Hello and welcome to the Stansberry Investor Hour. I'm your host, Dan Ferris. I'm also the editor of Extreme Value, published by Stansberry Research.
And I'm Corey McLaughlin, editor of the Stansberry Daily Digest. Today, Dan talks with James St. Aubin, Chief Investment Officer for Sierra Mutual Funds and Ocean Park Asset Management.
And for our opening rant, Taiwan elections and more.
And as always, you can email us at feedback@investorhour.com and tell us what's on your mind.
That and more right now on the Stansberry Investor Hour. So, Corey, you're more into this Taiwan election thing than I am. What do you think is the story here? What's the big takeaway?
Well, yeah, obviously a lot of people are talking about what's going on in China right now with these protests, and it's making headlines. But over the weekend, as I was awakening from my Thanksgiving day, post-Thanksgiving slumber, I saw these Taiwan elections where basically they had a lot of local elections over the weekend for mayors and, you know, local governments and that sort of thing. And the results showed support for the Nationalist Party, which is, you know, the opposition party to the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, which was campaigning more on the concern of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. And so actually the Taiwanese president resigned over the weekend from the leadership of her own party. Sounds like the UK, actually.
yeah, it does.
And that's just kind of an interesting story, I think, because, you know, we've been talking a lot, or a lot of people have been talking a lot about the possibility of China invading Taiwan or taking over Taiwan. And the people of Taiwan basically just voted in local leaders that aren't as concerned about that as the ruling party that's been in power.
I find that very interesting, but not surprising. I had a guy who I, actually one of our readers a while ago, tell me that he's been living in China for a while. And he says, you know, there's lots of Chinese people already working in Taiwan, and nobody really talks about this very much. As being so, nobody in Taiwan seems to talk about it nearly as much as the rest of us do. And I don't know, that's probably really an important thing to note. You know, it's like a US and other, you know, rest of the world issue, much more than an actual issue for people who live in Taiwan.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, I'm not an expert by any means, but from what I was reading about it, the people who, and there's enough people who don't want to be completely sealed off from China, who see the benefits of it and want kind of the status quo to remain in place. I mean, who wants their country to just be completely upended in any way? You know, when you break it down to that level, so it makes sense. It reminds me of one of these things where the high level governments are doing one thing. And geopolitics is one thing, and what people actually care about on the ground every day is something else. And that's a story as old as time, I guess.
Yes, it is. Like, if you never saw a screen for a whole month, there's so many things that you wouldn't think about that you would not miss at all that don't touch your life. I mean, even, I don't know, this probably isn't fair, but like you'd notice the price of things going up probably, but I wonder if your anxiety about it would be as high.
Right.
You know, I wonder if you're...
I thought that too.
Yeah. Because you add on top of dealing with the price of things going up, which is something people deal with, there's this added layer of, you know, just politics and news, I think, that does add to the anxiety of it. Not to, you know, dismiss how difficult it is for people when the price of things goes up at all.
Right. But if
probably
you just,
the wrong example to make the point. But.
No, it's a good point. I've actually thought about that too. We've talked about inflation. We've beat that to a pulp over the last year, you know, and prices are higher, right? Nobody wants that. But inflation's been around as long as, you know, fiat money has existed. So it's there, but yeah, and then you throw on the political discussion around it, and it does seem to make it worse. I don't know what's worse, the higher prices or the anxiety caused by the discussion about the higher prices, I guess, is what is a worthy thought to have.
Maybe this is like, you know, two rich financial guys have no business talking about it. But the truth is, like, you're right. Is which is worse, the anxiety or the actual thing? Because the actual higher price is something that people adapt to. It's something they deal with and live with. But the anxiety is just this free-floating thing you can't do anything about. Anyway, I don't want to become a psychological podcast, but you get the point. And if you're living in Hawaii, that anxiety is even higher right now because the world's biggest active volcano started erupting Sunday night. Did you hear about this? I did not. I mean, I live on the West Coast, did not hear about
that. I heard something. I did hear about it indirectly this morning. Somebody was talking about the Yellowstone geyser for some reason, and I think that's why.
I live a little bit closer to that one. That one would be
more concerning. And,
and it would be so enormous that, you know, it doesn't matter how close you are.
Hawaii, wow, that's... as if we didn't need anything else to be happening in the world today.
Yeah. It just feels like one of these sort of, ominous portents. It's with everything else happening in the world, you don't want to hear about a volcano. And for me, I'm kind of obsessed with this global currency thing because I keep seeing examples. Like the latest example is in the country of Ghana in Africa, which was like one of the great sort of growing economies in Africa. And of course they do what every growing economy in a place like Africa does. They borrowed way too much money, too much of it in foreign currency. I think mostly euros in their case. It's always one of the big reserve currencies, right? Dollars, euros, yen. And of course their currency is now the worst performing one in the past year, down close to 60% because they need to get more currency, and the only thing they have to get it with is their currency, right? So that's the dynamic that plays out. I mean, what fascinates me is that in Ghana, here they are, they've borrowed too much, they need more currency, more foreign currency, and their own currency is tanking as a result. And there are other aspects of this too. But what really interests me is that the dynamic with little teeny Ghana is the exact same dynamic with like Japan or England.
Right.
The two episodes, the same dynamic, which, you know, it kind of tells you something about the influence of reserve currencies in the world. And Ghana did this thing where they said they're going to require all the gold miners in the country because that's the big industry there to sell them 20% of their gold. And they're going to pay them with Ghana currency called the CEDI, CEDI, CEDI. And I mean, of course, where are they going to get the CEDIs? They're going to print them, right? And what are the gold mining company going to do as soon as they get the CEDIs? They're going to sell them for something else, right? I mean, that currency is toast.
Yeah, and that's playing out all over the world in all these developing emerging markets, right now because of the strong dollar and... still, I guess, relatively strong euro compared to, not compared to the dollar, but compared to everything else. So it's
right.
You really do wonder what the outcome of all of that, of what you're describing is ultimately. I can't imagine it's anything stable.
No, I think it's all the stability of an erupting volcano is where I was headed with this.
All right. You're coming back to the volcano. All right.
Yeah. So it's erupting and it's like, but it's slow, you know, and it doesn't fill the headlines week after week. It sort of pops up and then it goes back down. It's whack-a-mole, you know, so it pops up, goes back down, pops up and people don't get a chance to get really terrified about it. And then one day, all of a sudden, you know, you live in a place like, well, it wasn't too long ago, Sri Lanka, you know, they defaulted on their debt. And then a month later, the government disappeared, you know, just evaporated in front of everyone's eyes.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so it's scary. That happens in the little tiny places.
Well, and then relatively quietly, I think it was last week or the week before, the U.S. government hit the pause button on the student loan payments again. Mm. So it's like. Right. adding to the inflationary storm here quietly, you know, and that's the thing that's, you know, let's go back to the US here, because that's where we live. But the, you know, there's going to be this push and pull within this inflationary environment or era or whatever you want to call it, of inflation higher than people have seen in 40 years. And this fiscal policies and all the policy spending policies that people have known for their entire lives, mostly. So it's, and calls for more of it. So it's really, I don't know. Something's got to give.
Something does got to give. And in the end, it's always the currency. And I think, you know, right now, it's the epic struggle. It's always an epic struggle between the currency and the bond market, right? So that's what you see in, you know, that's what we've seen in little places like Ghana and Sri Lanka and big places like the UK and Japan. You know, there's this struggle between, they're trying to save the debt market, trying not to kill the currency. And in the end, the currency always is the one that gets killed. They always try to save the debt market by killing the currency. And I think the United States does become that eventually, but it's the last one, you know, because it's the big reserve. It's the one everybody needs to try to save their debt markets, right?
Yeah.
So it is in high demand, even as treasuries may not be in high demand, because people, the dynamic is they all own dollars in the form of treasuries. So they sell the treasuries to get dollars to buy back their own currency. It's, you know, it's this hypertrophy of finance that George Gilder talked to us about when he was on the show. And so it's a weird dynamic. And I don't think in the end, it winds up not being very good for, like, you know, whole civilizations, whole countries, whole cultures.
Yeah. Which brings us back to, you know, the whole Taiwan discussion, you know, what the government's doing versus what the people want or would prefer, whether they know what's happening or not. You know, most people on the street out here, and, you know, are not fluent in reserve currencies, nor should they. Yeah. So it's
right.
It's
they don't know what it is. Yeah.
I mean,
they don't know what it is. They don't know what a central bank is.
Yeah. That's part of the reason I got into this whole industry, is because just to learn about finance and money, because it's just not taught anywhere. And you get to these points and, you know, of these instances with 40-year high inflation, and you're like, well, what does this mean? You know, most people are like, well, what the hell does this mean? You know, and how did we get here? And then they just get angry over whatever political parties in power or whoever is the easiest person to blame, or, you know, try to path of least resistance, you know, try to find that. And then that causes all kinds of chaos, which is what we've been seeing the last 2 years. And it's, I don't know. It all comes back to the currencies, unfortunately, I think, is what I've been realizing more and more.
Right. And that level of ignorance that you point out, which is completely understandable, lets people like Liz Warren and Bernie Sanders and probably people on the right, too. I don't care about right or left, but just political people say things like, you know, grocery stores and oil and gas companies are causing inflation. I mean, you know, they don't print money. I promise. They don't cause inflation. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, what are we not supposed to have any businesses at all? Yeah.
Yeah. In the 70s, they blamed it on labor unions for causing inflation. That was absurd, too. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. Like when you know, Biden is, I don't care who, which president it is telling a gas station owner to charge less for gas. Like, come on. What are we talking about here? Like,
yeah,
and it's insane,
right? And I forget who it was that came out recently and said, you know, don't give your workers raises or something like that. Some politician, I can't remember off the top of my head, but you just reminded me of it. It's absurd.
Yeah.
Oh well. If only everybody knew what you and I knew, the world would be a wonderful place, would it not? I mean, come on.
Well, yeah. I think it'd be a little. I think it'd be a little. More peaceful if people were financially literate and knew what their governments and the people in power are actually doing with every decision that they make. And most of the time it's just kicking the can down the road for somebody else to deal with. And that's a problem.
Yeah. There is a gap out there. There is an opportunity for a whole lot of people to become more financially literate. That is for sure. And if they did so, maybe they would fall for fewer, you know, weird vaporware cryptocurrencies and and other similar kind of scammy things.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Well, having solved the world's problems.
Once again.
Having solved the world's problems, maybe we should talk good with an actual expert who knows about these things and is wisely less willing to try to solve them. Our guest, James St. Aubyn. James is a very smart guy, very knowledgeable, and very sane and rational. unlike, you know, myself 100% of the time, I won't speak for Corey. So let's find out what's on James's mind. Let's talk to him. Let's do it right now. One of the most successful entrepreneurs in America over the past 50 years is going public with his fourth and final prediction about a scenario he calls America's nightmare winter. Woo. You've probably never heard of Bill Bonner, but in addition to owning an interest in businesses all over the globe, he also owns more than 100,000 acres with massive properties in South America, Central America, and the U.S., plus three large properties in Europe. And I've been to one of them. It's gorgeous, gorgeous chateau. And I've known Bill for many, many years. He hired me into this business. And he says, we're about to enter a very strange period in America, which could result in the most difficult times we've seen in many, many years. And he's made three similar predictions in his 50-plus year career. And each time it proved to be exactly right. Although he was mocked each and every time, and I remember all of them. This is why I strongly encourage you to read about Bonner's fourth and final prediction, totally free today. It's all spelled out in a free report that we've put together called America's Nightmare Winter. Get the facts yourself. Go to www.nightmarewinterscenario.com to get your free copy of this report. Even if he's only partially right, it'll dramatically affect you and your money. So again, go to www.nightmarewinterscenario for this free report. All right, it's time for our interview. And today's guest is James St. Aubyn. James is the Chief Investment Officer for Sierra Investment Management. He's an accomplished investment management executive. His career of more than 20 years includes leadership roles in asset allocation, manager research, and portfolio construction. James is also a board member and treasurer for Children's Bureau of Southern California, a local nonprofit organization focused on primary prevention of child abuse, a worthy cause. James, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so you're new to the Investor Hour family, and we would like to get to know you a little bit. So I'm going to ask you my sort of classic get-to-know-you asset manager question, which is simply if you and I met in a bar and we struck up a conversation, and the conversation turned to finance, and I said, what kind of an investor are you? How might you respond to that?
Yeah, sure. So I guess I would say that I'm an investor that focuses on risk and optimizing risk, minimizing risk, of course, and focusing on the maximization of return, which sounds very generic, but it's really about finding portfolio solutions that are geared toward achieving the outcomes that we're trying to get to. So I would say that most of my career has been focused on multi-asset solutions and looking for the right level of risk for individual investors and how to optimize risk-taking within financial markets.
All right. I saw on your website, on the Sierra website, which I found interesting, by the way, I encourage listeners to go there. I saw one description of, it said, our tactical investment disciplines were developed with the goal of limiting downside risk to 5%, even in a down month or quarter. And that single sort of point there really attracted me because I thought, well, these guys must be crushing it this year, you know, with everyone getting really hammered. And I thought, wow, most people in your business are probably trying to keep the assets from running out the door. But how are you guys doing?
Well, we're very fortunate. We're in an environment that's very favorable on a relative basis for our performance, that's for sure. We focused on drawdown mitigation. Our Sierra was founded 35 years ago by David Wright and Dr. Ken Sleeper. I believe we've had Dave on the show in the past. At that time, back in the 80s, they recognized something very important, that the pain of large drawdowns, portfolio drawdowns for investors, particularly those that were either in or near retirement, mm-hmm. created a lot of psychological distress and it certainly had a great impact on outcomes. So they researched a lot of solutions, potential solutions to this problem, how to mitigate these big drawdowns, like the one we're in right now in both the stock and bond market. And they felt that following a price momentum strategy can help truncate the impact of these big market drawdowns with really out sacrificing a lot of the upside. So we have a trailing stop under every position that we hold in our funds. And that keeps us out of, like, as we say, trouble, meaning that we can avoid, when these drawdowns continue, participating in those drawdowns. Now, we will not avoid all impact to the drawdown, but we've done, I think, a really good job sidestepping some of these big drawdowns like we've seen very frequently, more and more frequently, it feels like, in the last few years.
So trailing stops, this, of course, is a topic near, you probably don't know this, but near and dear to Stansberry Research's heart. I mean, it's a widely used tool in all the Stansberry Research, you know, newsletters and research products and trading services and everything. And that is the primary sort of risk limiting tool that you use?
That's right. It's our primary risk mitigation tool. And it's been very successful, as I said earlier, to mitigating some of these big drawdowns. I think if you look across the trading landscape in terms of the population of folks that trade markets on a day-to-day basis, a trailing stop is a critical function for almost every successful trader. And that was something that Dave and Ken recognized 35 years ago and felt it was not used for most retail clients, and decided to bring these solutions to life for that reason.
Well, that has echoes of my colleague, Dr. Steve Sugarud, who was the guy who kind of brought trailing stops into the fold here and helped sort of propagate their use. So the key question then becomes, what level do you set the stop at? How do you determine where to set the stop on a particular position?
Well, Dan, we use what are called banded moving averages, and our stops are set at the upper end of the lower bound of that band. So when the price, a shorter term exponential moving average price of each holding breaks below that band, that's an automatic sell and we move into cash.
Sounds easy peasy, simple.
Easy.
So this subject of trailing stops, like, there's a discipline here, oddly enough, that it makes people really uncomfortable. We do get a little bit of resistance sometimes. People say, you mean if it goes down, I just sell it and that's it? Like, do you ever have clients like questioning you, saying, you sold that stock, it's a great business, et cetera, et cetera? Do you get that kind of pushback from clients?
Not really, because we do, I think, a pretty good job of explaining what we do and why we do it. We're very clear about our process and very transparent about our process. And yes, it does sound a bit simplistic, but if you believe that price momentum is, and it certainly has a lot of empirical research behind it and academic research, I would say that if you believe in that process, then that makes a lot of sense. And we try to be very careful about articulating our process to our clients and why we think it is an important risk mitigation tool.
I like the topic of when to sell. So hitting a stop is one time when you sell. Can you tell me more about sell discipline and when you would exit a position otherwise?
So we primarily invest in mutual funds and ETFs, mm-hmm. either broad-based market products or maybe more narrow sector-based products. Mm-hmm. But primarily, each one of those has a custom trailing stop, as I mentioned earlier, with those bands around the price. Mm-hmm. And when that price crosses below the upper end of the lower band, that's an automatic sell for us. Mm-hmm. And of course, then we can wait to buy that back when we see what we think is a sustainable uptrend. And that's the key, right? You not only have to be able to get out of the market when the markets are, you know, creating an unfavorable environment, but you have to get back in to participate on the upside. So really, I think our sell stops are very hard and fast. We don't have any discretion if it moves below that lower band, and everything is customized. So it's not a generic sell signal. It's really on and the asset class level, it's really based on individual funds' own behavior. And I think that's very important.
Okay. So that's the sell discipline. Hits the stop, you're out. and you don't worry about, you know, trying to capture more gains at the top of the band or anything like that.
Yeah. The way I would articulate it is to say we're really just trying to find some asymmetry between the downside capture and the upside capture. Mm-hmm. And if we can cut off more of the left tail and less of the right tail during this process, we can have, I think, a better client experience and outcome for portfolios.
So are all your products and all your portfolios, is it all based on this idea of momentum? Or are there other?
Yes.
Okay.
No, we have products that have different, we have six funds, three are multi-asset funds, meaning fixed income and equity, and three funds that are solely focused on fixed income. Each one of them has the exact same discipline applied to each holding that it can hold based on its mandate.
Oh, I see. So the different products are about, sounds like they're about different assets. More than, you know, they're
simple. Right. So we have products, again, that do invest in equities and fixed income. And those products are certainly a little bit more risky than our fixed income oriented products. Mm-hmm. But overall, they all apply the same discipline to each holding that's they hold.
Okay. So, you know, just looking down some of the list here on your website, like if you're buying, you know, high yield bonds, municipal bonds, that's still ETFs and mutual funds?
That's still, yes. We don't buy individual securities. We're a fund of funds.
Okay, fund of funds. All right. Well, that kind of simplifies things, doesn't it? I mean, it makes it a lot easier.
It certainly does. We have a lot of respect for the folks that have a more macro discretionary views and or fundamental views based on based on their signals. But for us, what works and has worked consistently over 35 years is this simple process applied religiously to each holding. And over time, we found that just provides a better risk-adjusted return relative to what a buy and hold strategy would have produced. So that's our main focus, is really just trying to provide, as I said earlier, a better risk-adjusted return and a better client experience overall. Because again, we work in a sort of a very theoretical framework, but our industry has a lot of, you know, practical problems with investor psychology that we have to deal with on a day-to-day basis, and advisors have to face on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, it's certainly, again, about improving outcomes, but most also, just as importantly, that psychological distress that comes in those periods of big drawdowns, again, like we are today, where people look at their statements and, you know, really have a lot of distress. That's something that we can help with.
So do you short any of the ETFs or buy short ETFs?
No, we do not buy short ETFs. We can in one of our funds use an inverse ETF to cover our long positions. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, most of the time, we do invest in cash as an alternative when we don't have a buy signal.
Got it. So we actually have interviewed quite a few folks who do a version of this. They're not fund of funds, but, you know, there are a lot of like, we interviewed Jack Schwager and a couple of the Market Wizards folks. So they're very mm-hmm. much, you know, they're all about the stops. And they, my question though is, you know, they tend to monitor like, you know, 50 markets or 70 markets or something, because they're trading futures and anything. They'll trade anything. What does that look like for you? What are you guys monitoring, looking for a buy signal?
Well, I will say, again, going back to my comment earlier, Dave and Ken recognize those successful traders that you mentioned. Yeah. And what has made them successful and what they tend to focus on is the stop discipline. So where they may look at assets, individual stocks or bonds, or we tend to think about it a little bit more simplistically in the sense of mutual funds and ETFs. So for example, our tactical bond fund will look at high yield corporate bonds primarily as the when those are in an uptrend, we'll own high yield corporate bonds or longer term treasuries. So those are sort of a binary option for us. We have two options to be long. And then of course, if neither of those is in an uptrend, we'll be in cash. So that, you know, a lot of these traders, frankly, are much more short term.
Yes.
In nature. They will trade day to day, intraday. on average, we tend to find what we call two round trips per year in our asset classes. Our strategy is designed not to create an incredible amount of turnover that you would see in a more aggressive trading strategy. Mm-hmm. So what we try to do is really limit the round trips and avoid, you know, some of the volatility that you might see in those more aggressive strategies.
Okay. So do you apply leverage in any of your strategies?
No, we do not.
No leverage. All right. And I love this because we actually got to the topic of risk pretty quickly, but we always wind up there. Like we always wind up here with folks like yourself. There, you know, risk mitigation becomes the whole sort of shebang. It's the big focus. And the funny thing is, of course, like clients and retail folks, they're always looking at upside. It's like, how much am I going to make? And you're sitting there saying, well, we're not going to lose more than this much. And, you know, there can be difficult moments with clients. And and my question then is, you mentioned psychology and, you know, the difficulties with that. Were you referring to like conversations with clients at that point?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we like to say we win by not losing.
Yep.
And you know, the famous quote from Ben Graham that the essence of investment management is the management of risk, not the management of return, sometimes gets lost, right? In markets like we saw in 2020 and 2021, where we had a pretty steady uptrend there for a long time that persisted, very low volatility. And then we come into 22 and everybody starts remembering, we have to think about risk again. We never forget about it. So it's a core focus of our strategy. And we think ultimately over the long term, risk management is really what will be the foundation for success.
Man, I feel like we should stop right there because that's the nugget, isn't it? Risk management is the foundation for success. It's hard to beat that. So one thing I do want to talk with you about, James, that was kind of different this year is that, you know, folks use bonds to like sort of mitigate their losses in stocks. Like 60-40 has been this idea that's been ongoing for a long time. And that obviously got killed this year. And it made me wonder, as you were speaking a moment ago, I wonder when Sierra was out of TLT, the long bond fund.
Right. Well, it's been a very, very difficult year in fixed income investing. And I don't know if we ever envisioned this type of drawdown in this type of market, but it certainly does play into the hands of our strategy. We have been buying, we haven't been in cash all year. We have had some instances, we've seen some rallies, both in fixed income and equities this year that turned out to be false starts, if you will.
Yep.
So we have been invested in and out of individual positions throughout the year. We never know when that uptrend will be sustained. Mm-hmm. So we don't try to predict that. We just follow the trend. And if the trend leads us to a buy signal, we will be invested. It may be for a short time, depending on how fickle the market might be. Mm. But I think coming into 2022, we were talking about the risk that a lot of advisors may not have recognized in fixed income or may not have fully appreciated, let's just say that, in terms of the extension or the increase in duration of investment grade bonds relative to the yield.
Yep.
So you had this very really bad setup, if you will, from a fundamental perspective in terms of a return per unit of risk in fixed income. You had return going down and risk going up as measured by the sensitivity to interest rate moves. So here we are in this very violent drawdown, historic drawdown in fixed income markets. And so our process, you know, not necessarily predicting this type of market environment, definitely reacted. We like to say we react, we don't predict. We reacted to the market drawdown, sold and have been in cash for most of the year, save a few instances when we saw some rallies as rates fell, rates started to fall, you know, for a short period of time during the year.
So when you say been in cash, what kind of percentages are we talking here?
So right now our funds are between 90 and 100% in cash.
Wow.
So we do have a few small positions in the equity market. There haven't, as you know, haven't been a lot of places to hide.
Yeah.
There have been not many uptrends, but there are a few pockets of strength within the equity markets. And of course, commodities is in some of our funds is an option. So we have some small positions there, but for the most part, it's been hanging out in cash. And right now, you're actually getting paid to be on the sidelines, unlike some not too distant past where that hasn't been the case.
Wow. So we had a guest recently, and I think he said he was 76%. You guys manage billions. He's a much smaller guy, but I think it was 76% in cash. And I thought, wow, nobody goes that far, but you got him beat there at 90 to 100%. That's
incredible. We're definitely not afraid. Yeah, we're definitely not afraid to be in cash, and yeah. We think it is the safe haven, the only safe haven that we've had this year. Unlike traditionally, bonds can be a safe haven in equity market drawdowns. That obviously hasn't been the case this year. So cash is king. You know, that's what we've been saying to our clients right now.
Yeah. I mean, good on you. That is awesome to hear that. But of course, you know, you're very obviously not dealing with the, you know, the mandates and things that prevent a lot of institutions from doing that, right?
That's true. I mean, we set our strategies up to be very tactical, mm-hmm. to be completely tactical. Mm-hmm. And unlike most strategies, they have a buy and hold approach, which, you know, we don't necessarily buy into, but we don't, that's not, for some folks that works. Mm-hmm. For us, we felt like the better approach would be to be tactical and not participate, if we can avoid it, in these big drawdowns, which are, again, very devastating to portfolio values. And coming back to the genesis of the firm, thinking about folks that are in retirement or near retirement, you start to get into a situation where that affects the outcome, how long they can sustain their lifestyle in retirement on their portfolios. And when you're in a drawdown and making withdrawals or distributions from your portfolio, you sort of magnify the impact of these big drawdowns. And so you're thinking about dollar weighted rate of returns rather than a time weighted rate of returns. Mm. And there's a big difference there in these scenarios where you do have distributions. So that was really the problem that they set out to solve. And the way they found to be the best and most effective way to do that was to use this trailing stop process.
Yeah. James, you make it sound just positively easy and delightful of a process.
you really have to focus on taking the emotion out of it, right? That, and I think that that's why it sounds easy. And I think what appealed to us was the fact that we weren't making any subjective calls on what's going to happen to interest rates, what's going to happen to equity markets, what's the Fed going to do. We do certainly think about that. We talk about what's driving narratives, what's behind the trend, but it doesn't, as we've seen, predictions are very difficult. And you just think about even the Fed, who, you know, a lot of folks would assume have the foresight to understand what's going to happen in the future from an economic and policy perspective, but have been very wrong in their calls and their expectations about where policy was going to be. Yeah. Remember this time, last year, they were expecting to hike rates once in 22.
Yeah.
And here we are, you know, above 3%, yeah, and with more to go, we're probably going to end up, you know, close to over 4%. Mm-hmm. So that's a big turnaround. And it's a proof point that even those with, you know, expertise, if you will, have difficult foreseeing the future. That's why we said, look, can it be done? Yes, there are some great macro discretionary investors out there. It's hard to do consistently.
Yeah.
And that's where a discipline comes into play that doesn't takes out the guesswork, if you will, of market navigation. And so again, the trailing stop process keeps us out of trouble, keeps our investors out of trouble. And to us, that is a really important feature of our investment approach.
Right. So this raises a question then for me. You're thinking about those macro issues, you're discussing them, but you made it clear earlier, there's no discretion. When you hit the stop, you're out and that's it. When the signal and on the entry, I assume it's the same way. You get the buy signal, you buy and that's it. So what function do these discussions have? It doesn't sound like it's really part of the process. It sounds like something you just can't help talking about around the office.
That's true. We like to think of ourselves as market junkies, and we certainly enjoy the attribution of what's happening to certain market events. But as you know, we've seen several market reactions that seem to be counterintuitive to the data. And, you know, looking at that, and you try to say, what's driving the markets today? And sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not so obvious to us. And we definitely like to understand what's happening in the market from an intellectual curiosity perspective. But as far as feeding that back into the process. It's really not part of our job.
Yeah. But yeah.
we love, like anybody else, love to discuss, backstory, the market environment, what's driving the big trends that we're seeing.
Okay. So James, I'm reminded of a trip that I took many years ago. It might've been 20 years already to, let's just say, one of the turtle trader firms, so-called turtle trader firms.
Right.
And we were walking around the trading floor and there was like a vice president guy and he said, okay, I'm going to leave you in the hands of our head trader here. And, he let us look at the screens and see everything he was doing. He explained everything. And I'll never forget, he had a chart in his hand and he said, it was cable, British pound.
Yeah.
And he said, well, that's a signal right there. And then he said, but do you really want to sell cable after 5 days of this? Because it was down for 5 days. And I thought, that sounds like discretion to me. That doesn't sound right. Like you're following. I mean, there were like 10 math PhDs on the floor below and computer guys, kicking out signals and thinking about the system and all this. And this guy's saying, do you really want to sell? It was an enlightening moment. Just let's say, does that occur at Sierra?
We do have those conversations. We're human beings by nature, right? Yeah. And we look at the process and what it's telling us. And sometimes it feels maybe counterintuitive at some level, what the signals are giving us. But we have to remove ourselves from that. We don't react. We don't act on our own gut, if you will, because when you start doing that, of course, you are removing, you are adding discretion into the process. Mm-hmm. And as much as we all have our opinions about which direction the market is going or whether a signal is going to be sustained or not sustained, we have to just disconnect ourselves from those reactions, from those impulses to second guess the strategy, second guess the signal. So we really don't let that happen. And that's, I think, have been key to our success is not letting that creep in and second guessing, because again, this strategy has been around for 35 years. It's time tested. So the fact that, what we might have, our own biases, we were not going to put that into the approach and change it after it's been working successfully for such a long time.
Yeah. It's gotta, that first time, once you do it that first time, you're in chaos. You violated the whole, reason for the existence of the, you've injected emotion essentially back into the process, right?
You open up Pandora's box.
Yes.
And I think that's generally where people get into trouble, honestly, is where they start to second guess the strategy, because I think any quantitative investment manager will tell you, they've had that moment of, is this working? Is this not working? And tries to, think about it, at least, if not act on it, but think about what the signal might be missing.
Right.
And the only way you stay successful, I think, as a quantitative manager, is to stick to the discipline and do research, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want to, again, use our own judgment about whether or not a signal is still effective or not. We will go back and study that signal and see if the performance is still, over a longer term time period, still working. But if it's not, for a short period of time, we cannot impart our own judgment here, or else we're probably setting ourselves up for a failure.
Right. Nothing works all the time. Nothing works forever. Right.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Right. That nothing, in my former life, I was a gatekeeper and manager research. So I've seen a lot of different strategies, both fundamental and quantitatively based strategies. And I think the key, whether or not you are a key focus of mine really was, are they sticking to their disciplines? Are they, if they change their stripes, whether it's a fundamental or a quantitative strategy, that's usually a red flag and a reaction to something that may not be working over the short term.
Interesting. Wow. It just never fails to fascinate me how I can talk to James, I'm talking like a few dozen folks who really follow this same basic model of, momentum in, stops out, That's it. No discretion. And yet still there are 50 different personalities. There are 50 different styles, 50 different ways of looking at the same thing. It's fascinating to me. You'd think they'd all wind up buying the same stuff at the same time and selling the same stuff at the same time, but it doesn't happen.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think there's, I always like to say there's more than one way to skin a cat. Oh, yeah. And I think that is, you know, everybody has their own approach that works for them in the technical, looking at whether it's technical or quantitative strategies. And I don't think there's necessarily a right or wrong way to do it or a perfect way to do it. Everyone has their own parameters and has their own risk tolerance. And mm-hmm. we've dialed ours in to meet the needs of our clients. So it's very much connected to the practical side of our investment strategy and what our clients want and what we can deliver, what we think we can deliver in our funds.
Cool. I'm still amazed by the 90-100% cash. I have to admit that's been churning in my mind, in the back of my mind, and it's awesome and it's wonderful, I think.
No, I was just saying I think I'll stress that we have been invested at different points mm-hmm. during the year, and those rallies have been short-lived. But I would say for overall, we don't think of cash as a long-term investment. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be there for a long time.
Right.
So even though it's obviously has some yield now, we'd still rather be invested in productive income producing or capital appreciation assets that are expected to have some capital appreciation over the longer term.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say on average, we're in cash maybe 20% of the time and invested in in our respective asset classes about 80% of the time.
Gotcha.
This year, it's sort of been the opposite. We've been in cash 80% of the time and invested about 20% of the time.
Right.
But it's a very unusual market environment, and our signals are reflecting that.
So I normally, I can't believe I haven't gotten to this question yet. It would normally be like one of the first items. So we've talked about how you your sell discipline, and I've just kind of assumed that the buy discipline is very similar. Like you're waiting for a signal. You get the signal, no discretion, you're in, correct?
That's true, but there's a slight difference. So obviously we're selling when the price hits the upper end of the lower band. When the price moves above the most recent bottom of the upper band, plus a more secondary signal in that one, which doesn't apply to the sell signal, is a more intermediate term moving average.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a more intermediate term moving average to confirm that uptrend. So in some cases, you can cross the lower bound or the upper band and still not have a buy signal until it crosses that intermediate term trend line. And once it does, then it becomes a buy signal. And the reason we do that is to make sure that it is a true uptrend and we're not getting more of a head fake. So we want to see more evidence of a sustainable uptrend on the buy signal.
I see. I remember when I first, years and years ago, when I first read the Market Wizards books and was finding out about this way of looking at markets, one of them revealed that they were, I think he said they were buying like 21-day breakouts. Is that the type of assessment that you make? A similar sort of when you get a buy
signal? I don't know about that particular strategy. I don't think we would consider our what I call breakout. Mm-hmm. We're not looking for that. And I think that's more of a shorter term strategy. What we'd like to obviously invest in is a long term sustainable uptrend and not trying to capture a profit on a 1 day, 2 day, 5 day move. For our process to work, on the upside, right, that we want to have a sustainable sustainable uptrend, and being whipsawed in and out of positions or trying to trade on a day-to-day basis isn't part of our strategy.
I see.
We think, we will look in a perfect world. We'll see a recovery, sustained recovery, the types you typically see coming out of big bear markets, the rallies, and we want to be able to capture that. So once we get the buy signals in our funds, in our fund universe, we'll add to positions. And our hope is that we hold those positions for quite some time. We don't, like I said, cash is a last resort for us. We're really just trying to cut off those big tail events that we've seen, again, more and more frequently, 2018, 2020, 2022.
Yeah.
And of course, you can go back to the global financial crisis or the dot-com bubble. Mm-hmm. Our strategies were able to successfully navigate those areas and limit that drawdown. Again, by winning by not losing is the key. We're not trying to create any sort of, as some of the more, you know, sort of famous traders might do, create these quick trips and capture small profits consistently over time.
I see. Interesting. I was going to ask you about the financial crisis and the dot-com. I'm glad you mentioned them. And basically, at that time, like the strategy hasn't changed meaningfully since then.
You know, it's even beyond that. It's been back to the late 80s. It hasn't changed meaningfully from there. We do, you know, do research on our signals and maybe try to tweak them to some degree to make them a little bit more effective. But the foundation of the process, the core of the process has been in place for 35 years. And that's why we think it's so reliable. It's time tested. You know, it was studied before it was implemented. And then out of sample over 35 years, it continues to deliver the behavior of our portfolios that we expect and wow. Sidestep these big drawdowns. And we've been able to do that successfully and just be able to cut off those left tail events is a huge win because you have to make up that, you know, obviously the bigger the drawdown, the more you have to recover. So if we can, again, truncate that drawdown, we don't have to recover as much. And so it's sort of a, it's a little bit of a tortoise and the hare, right? We can win by not losing. We can just chip away at performance over time. It will build a really robust profile of risk-adjusted returns.
Right. So, James, it's time for the final question. And the final question that I ask, it's the exact same question for every guest, no matter what the topic, even if sometimes every now and then we have a non-financial kind of a guest, exact same final question for everybody. And that is simply, if you could leave our listeners with one idea today, what would it be?
I think that taking a close look at one's portfolio and how it's being invested and whether that you are in the right portfolio for your level of risk tolerance. I think a lot of folks don't necessarily appreciate risk, as I said earlier, especially end investors. How much volatility, how much risk they're taking in the portfolio should be well understood. And we're getting to the point where if they're not in the right portfolio and we experience a large volatility event as we are now, that can be a mismatch. And I would suggest folks regularly check their portfolio and talk to their advisor about the level of risk they're comfortable with. Because I think oftentimes that gets lost in the discussion. And as you mentioned earlier, folks think about return and not the effect of risk. So just a kind of a reminder for everyone out there listening that your risk level should be the primary determinant of what portfolio you're in. And hopefully people are in tune to that.
All right. Thank you for that. And thanks for being here too. I really appreciate your spending some time with us.
Thanks, Dan. It's been great.
Yeah. And you're definitely going to get a call back from us at some point over the next, I don't know, 6-12 months or something. So be ready for that.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Thanks again, James.
Thanks, Dan.
Last year, when most investors were watching their stocks plummet, one Wall Street legend had an unfair advantage that was identifying winning stocks with massive upside, like Riot Blockchain before it shot up 10,090% in less than 12 months, Digital Turbine before it shot up 789% in 8 months, Overstock.com before it shot up 1,050% in 4 months, and more. Clients have paid as much as $5,000 per month to see this kind of research. But today, you can get a glimpse at his system, the Power Gauge, absolutely free. It's a new way to see which small stocks could soon be rated a buy across Wall Street and shoot up. By using a secret so powerful, CNBC's Jim Cramer once said even he doesn't want to bet against it. This Power Gauge comes from the legendary Mark Chaykin. Mark's the creator of one of Wall Street's most popular indicators, a system that appears on every Bloomberg terminal in the world and is used by banks, hedge funds, and every major brokerage site. He spent 50 years on Wall Street, survived and thrived in 9 bear markets. built three new indices for the NASDAQ where he once rang the opening bell. But today, Mark has turned his back on Wall Street and wants to show you how this unfair advantage works. Right now, you can get a free in-depth look at how his power gauge system works, a way to type in any of 4,000 different tickers and see exactly where the stock is most likely to go next and in any type of market. Simply go to www.trypowergauge.com for your free look. Again, that's www.trypowergauge.com. Well, I hope you heard on my final question, what topic did James go straight to? And even when we started out, what topic did we go straight to? It's risk. It's always risk. Professional asset managers who know what they're doing are all obsessed with risk. What's my downside? While their clients are saying, how much money am I going to make? The manager is saying, well, here's how much you're not going to lose. And it's not sexy, but it's got teeth. You know, it's real. That's how you really do it in the real world. And, you know, like academics, they look at things and they look at, you know, 50-100 year long-term returns. Oh, you should always be invested. But reality is quite different, isn't it? You know, when you're in those drawdowns and bear markets and god-awful sideways markets and things, you are a human being and your emotions can really mess you up. And, you know, guys like James, they sit around all day like they're obsessed with not getting messed up by their emotions. And that sense of discipline that he communicated to us, you know, when I challenged him on the Turtle Trader story, he was like, no, we stick to our guns. And that's what you need to do. It's hard, but obviously it's worth it, especially when a year like 2022 comes along. And that's another interview, another great interview, and another episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. We provide a transcript for every episode. Just go to www.investorhour.com, click on the episode you want, scroll all the way down, click on the word transcript, and enjoy. If you like this episode and know anybody else who might like it, tell them to check it out on their podcast app or at investorhour.com. And do me a favor, subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, help us grow with a rate and a review. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Our handle is @InvestorHour. On Twitter, our handle is @Investor_Hour. If you have a guest you want me to interview, drop us a note at feedback@InvestorHour.com or call the listener feedback line, 800-381-2357. Tell us what's on your mind and hear your voice on the show. Till next week, I'm Dan Ferris. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. To access today's notes and receive notice of upcoming episodes, go to investorhour.com and enter your email. Have a question for Dan? Send him an email, feedback@investorhour.com. This broadcast is for entertainment purposes only and should not be considered personalized investment advice. Trading stocks and all other financial instruments involves risk. You should not make any investment decision based solely on what you hear. Stansberry Investor Hour is produced by Stansberry Research and is copyrighted by the Stansberry Radio Network.
Opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the contributor and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Stansberry Research, its parent company, or affiliates. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this program as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of opinion. Neither Stansberry Research nor its parent company or affiliates warrant the completeness or accuracy of the information expressed on this program, and it should not be relied upon as such. Stansberry Research, its affiliates and subsidiaries are not under any obligation to update or correct any information provided on the program. The statements and opinions expressed on this program are subject to change without notice. No part of the contributor's compensation from Stansberry Research is related to the specific opinions they express. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Stansberry Research does not guarantee any specific outcome or profit. You should be aware of the real risk of loss in following any strategy or investment discussed on this program. Strategies or investments discussed may fluctuate in price or value. Investors may get back less than invested. Investments or strategies mentioned on this program may not be suitable for you. This material does not take into account your particular investment objectives, financial situation, or needs, and is not intended as a recommendation that is appropriate for you. You must make an independent decision regarding investments or strategies mentioned on this program. Before acting on information on the program, you should consider whether it is suitable for your particular circumstances and strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial or investment advisor.